This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
You're listening to iFanboy Talksplode with Brian Wood, writer of Demo, DMZ, Northlanders, and Deviate. Hey everybody, Ron from iFanboy here, and I want to welcome you to this latest edition of iFanboy Talksplode. This week we're talking to writer Brian Wood. In case you haven't noticed, this February of 2010 appears to be Brian Wood month, as demo number one just came out in stores this week. Next week we've got DMZ number 50, followed up by Northlanders number 25 coming out, and then later on in April, Deviate number one finally hit stands. I had a chance to catch up with Brian and hear about all these great projects and more.
Kind of a funny feeling because I've been writing all these books that are set to come out like ages ago, you know, and suddenly they're all going to come. I'm going to have like four monthly books.
Yeah, wow, jeez.
Coming out, I guess in April is when the fourth one is going to start.
Yeah. So to kind of lead it off, I got a little rundown here of all the stuff going. So Demo returns to comic book stores this week.
Yep.
For those who didn't read Demo the first time around, what is Demo?
Oh, okay. it's a lot of different things. Demo was, I guess, the basic concept of Demo is artist Becky Clunan and I sort of taking the well-worn subgenre in comics of the teenager with powers, and sort of like take we did it in a very ground level, very realistic, very like indie comics way. A friend of mine once called it Love and Rockets mixed with the X-Men, which is like very, very nice. I was very flattered to hear that. It's not exactly what it is, but it kind of gives you a ballpark idea. Taking with that like basic umbrella concept, we did these short stories, these done in one comics, completely unrelated to each other. It was really sort of like the ultimate in like the done in one comic, in that with each issue is an entirely different cast and different story, sometimes a completely different genre. But it all kind of fit under that umbrella concept. We like put a lot of it was a very high end single comic. Like the paper was really thick and shiny, and we put a lot of back matter into it. And it was kind of like I don't know if it was the first one, but it was like kind of like the first of like this recent crowd of indie comics doing that, like Fell and Casanova and Wasteland and Phonogram and stuff. They all sort of do that, you know, where we make this single issue kind of the preferred format, you know. with all the extras in the back and higher production values and stuff. So so we just sort of like jumped all over the map, just like kind of like tearing apart that concept of like the young person, you know, kind of at a crossroads in their life and not being normal, having something that makes them different. And it did really, really well. It did really well over time. It kind of became Becky and my calling card to Vertigo. It kind of got us both in there. And so we're doing it all over again.
Yeah. And so how long ago was the first series? It was like 6 years ago, right? Wasn't it? Or
yeah, almost exactly. It was November of 2003 when the first demo one came out. So
I remember picking up that issue and reading it and just thinking that it was just, you know, it was like, you know, like so many of the other kind of powered based comics I've read, but unlike it at the same time because it had that indie feel. So picking the title back up and working with Becky again after 6 years is like, do you guys just kind of click back into place, or have you both evolved as creators, and do you think the experience is a little sharper, or what was it like?
Yeah, I think everything you just said is right. I mean, it's very easy to start working with Becky again because we've stayed friends, and she lives close by, so I see her a lot. So in that respect, it was very easy to start working with her again. It was always the big thing for me. Like, one of the things that made me so excited to write this book again is just to see how Becky and I have both changed in terms of our skill, like the quality of our work. After 6 years and after so many thousands of comic book pages written and drawn, you know. But at the same time, it was actually a little bit hard because I had to kind of like unlearn a lot of what I've learned to get the demo. I mean, I'm so used to writing monthly books that are part of a larger storyline. That it was kind of like, I sort of had to regress a bit in order to capture like that free flow, flowing, very open kind of story style that demo is. Not that I regressed and made it crappy or anything, but it was definitely like very different muscles. It was a very like un-DC comics kind of way of working. And we sort of had to my editors were very like mindful of that, and so sort of like stayed out of the way. You know, didn't treat it like it was an issue of DMZ in terms of how hands on they are. All for the, you know, for the goal of recreating whatever the process was that Becky and I, you know, found to make demo in the first place.
And it's almost, I mean, it's interesting because you said that it's the ultimate, you know, kind of one and done. And the first series was totally that. There was no kind of thread that tied it through other than the fact that it was just young people with their powers. And it almost, you know, reminded me because like your work after demo with Local, it felt like it started that way, but then you introduced the thread of following the main girl throughout the whole thing, and it became awesome. Is it tough to hold that back? Like, did you at any moment that you're like, well, yeah, it would be great to do one and done, but I'm going to introduce this as a plot thread throughout the entire thing?
No, I think I really, I guess I'm saying I don't really have that urge. That it's kind of nice, you know, every time I start a demo script to know that everything I'm making, I can walk away from in 22 pages. I think it actually helps me to be a little creative, more so because, like, I'm not worrying about, you know, what's going to happen, you know, 20 issues down the line, or even like a dozen issues, you know. I can just sort of live in the moment with it. And I also think it's a good creative exercise. I think every writer, everybody that makes comics should sort of experience what it's like to spend the time in the creative juice, you know. You're like building a set of characters up only to like, you know, basically discard them at the end of a story. It's a good perspective, you know, honing, you know, exercise. So no, with that all I play really, really strapped. I think when we began the second run, a lot of people asked me if I was going to, like, you know, bring back any of the old characters, and like, I never will.
And a part of that, you know, a part of what makes Nemesis so special is that you're keeping the black and white format. Was there any at any moment do you and Becky think that, hey, you know, let's do it in color. We can. We've got the resources now. Or was it always meant to be a black and white?
Yeah, we really just didn't see any need to change it up. I mean, I think we were also a little bit wary of the possibility that if we brought demo back and it was like full color, like it would just look like a DC comic, and it would be like, oh man, like demo sold out, you know, or something, you know. We didn't want to like, you know, monkey with it too much. I felt like it was enough that we were, you know, bringing it from like a tiny indie company to Time Warner, you know.
Right, sure.
So so we didn't want to even have that be like a possibility, you know, have anybody have had the chance to like hold that against it. And we were just like very upfront with Karen Berger and my editor Will Adenis about it. You know, I was like, if I want to do this, I just want it to be as close to the original run. Like ideally, if these were ever put together into a single book, like I would hope that it wouldn't be obvious on the surface which was new and which was old. You know.
Sure. Yeah.
So like, you know, the letterer sort of like picked a very similar font, you know, for the dialogue, and we used all the same, like, you know, title fonts and everything. The covers are like very slightly changed, but basically the same. So that was kind of the goal, and every step of the way, you know, Vertigo was like cool with it. You know, there's no ads in the book. There's actually ads I see on the inside front and back covers, but in the actual book itself, there aren't any, which is nice.
Cool. And so issue number one came out in stores this week, and it's gonna be a 6-issue mini.
Is that
the case? Cool. And then
there's always a chance there'll be more. I think at the time I was unsure, and we hadn't actually begun writing it yet. And I was like, man, I hope we can pull this off again. Like it was kind of an unknown known to me. So I committed to a 6. And they're called like Volume 1 and now Volume 2. So obviously there's plenty there's a good chance there'll be more.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it's funny. Do you ever find yourself, because you're, you know, because they're single stories and you're creating a new character, but not only creating a new character and they're like whatever their story is, like in the case of this first issue, it's, you know, about a woman who's in San Francisco and she's got a boyfriend and a job, and, you know, and you introduce this power. Do you find yourself, you ever get challenged to not only create the character's like life, but then also, okay, well, what power is going to screw up that life?
I feel like I'm sort of, I mean, with the exception of a few of the very early demo stories that were very like archetypal powers, you know, like super strength or whatever. Like I do feel like I'm sort of like, you know, creating that too. At least up to a point. Like I always try to make something different about it. And these new stories are kind of have more of a supernatural slant.
Okay.
And like a superpower in the comic book sense. Like that, this first one, I mean, she has some sort of weird, I mean, there's kind of a twist to it, which I won't say, but there's, I guess I could say if this issue's already out.
Well, we want people to go pick it up. So it's
right. Well, I won't, but I'll just say that it's, you know, she has this like, you know, sort of like walking dream state that she's in, this pre-recognition thing, that has a twist, but that's not really like a conventional superpower, and it's not like she can like use it at will or whatever, you know. So it's a bit different, and like the second one, you know, it's just, I mean, I've already said in other interviews, so I don't mind saying it, but it's like a cannibal story, which really isn't a power per se, but I do feel like it, you know, kind of makes sense. I mean, it's like a thing he's burdened with, like some kind of a trait, you know, involuntary.
And it's funny because as I was reading the first issue, there's some, you know, you and Becky create a story that's got some great locations, and Becky really nailed it as far as, you know, depicting both San Francisco as well as London. Specifically the cathedral she drew just is amazing looking.
Yeah, I think I'm never gonna live that down. like I've been there myself, and Becky hasn't. And it was actually really hard to find photo reference of it because they don't really like allow you to take a lot of pictures. Like, I mean, I went to London recently, the last couple of years, and I was appalled at how few times I was allowed to take pictures.
Wow. Yeah.
They're really strict there, like a lot of like velvet ropes, like where you can and can't walk. It was a little strange. It was very different from when I went to Italy and I could literally walk up and touch like Galileo's tomb.
Yeah.
I felt like if I tried that in England, they would have like shot me or something. So I was struggling hard to find good photo reference, you know, that wasn't like a small little picture, you know, online. And I think at the end of it, Becky was like, I've drawn this thing so many times, I'm having dreams about it. You know, just kind of in a funny, like, art meets life.
Yeah,
kind
of thing. Say, yeah.
And she's like, I can draw this in my eyes closed. Like, screw you, Wood. You know?
But it's just so funny because you layer in the character piece, you lay in the power piece, but then you also put in the geographies, and this is like any fan of local would definitely eat this up, you know, just in terms.
Yeah,
of,
and yeah. I kind of feel like I've sort of absorbed that local thing to the point where I mean I do it in DMZ. I mean I kind of have to do it in DMZ, and it's sort of become an illness of mine.
Yeah,
much to my artist's dismay. But to my credit, I always give them all the reference I can find. I mean, I spend a lot of time, you know, handing them exact photo, like in the scripts, you know, be like, here's what I want you to draw, and here's a link to the exact thing,
right.
You know, so they don't have to waste their time, you know. Yeah. You know, fulfilling my many whims.
Cool. So you mentioned DMZ, and I want to move on to that. But before we do, so, you know, demo, issue number one, it's in comic book stores. You know, definitely pick it up if you didn't read the first one, or if you read the first one. Either way, it's a great, you know, one. It's one shot. It's only $2.99, so there's no reason not to pick it up, that's for sure.
There's no ads, which
yeah.
is nice.
Yeah,
so.
Cool. So DMZ number 50 comes out, and that's going to be in stores in the comic book stores on next week on February 10th. And I'm looking at the names associated with this issue, and talk about a 50th issue celebration. I mean, you got Jim Lee, Fabio Moon, Ryan Kelly, Philip Bond, Eduardo Risso, Dave Gibbons. Did DC just kind of hand you this team, or did you have to go around and beg? Or like?
No, it's like, and it's very much, well, Dave Gibbons, he actually did a variant cover of Northland and Lander, so it's not the first time I've had him, like, you know, go out of his way to, you know, to help me out. But it was really, I think, at the time we were thinking about this probably goes back almost a year now. Like, we knew this issue was coming up, and it just happened to come after the end of an arc. So it was like the perfect time to do something different. So I sort of had this thought. I mean, the thing that's always plagued me with this book is that there's so much possible story in the concept of DMZ. There's actually physically no way I could do it all. It's very hard for me to put everything that I personally want to say into the main storyline. Like, there's only so many pages, you know. So I thought this is a chance to sort of, like, you know, create this concept of, like, you know, Matty Ross sort of, like, field notes, all the things he might, like, see in a random day and jot down, you know. These sort of, like, very short snippets of random cool aspects of life in the DMZ. So my editor, Will, was like, well, you know, I'll bust open the Rolodex for this. You know, it'll be great. You know, we sort of had in mind kind of like those old Transmet specials.
Yeah, you know, that's what it reminded me of, big pages. Time.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to do that all the way through. I wanted to have some multi-page stories as well. So I think we have, God, I can't even think of it offhand. I think we have like five multi-page stories and about five, like, single pagers. And, you know, they run from, like, a couple of pages long up to, like, eight pages long. And, yeah, so that was it. And so then I just sort of, like, began writing them and trying to, like, pair them up with the artists as best I could. It got slightly touch and go towards the end there. with some of the bigger names who are obviously very, very busy. But, yeah, it all worked out great. I haven't actually seen colored pages of all of them yet. But yeah, I mean, it's really, I think it's a lighthearted book. I mean, DMZ can get really, really grim at times, and it's especially grim now. So I wanted to make a point of having this be, like, I wanted to celebrate it, you know? So for, like, the most part, it's, like, overwhelmingly positive stories, you know? And some of them are like a little, you know, lighthearted even. And, yeah, and it should be, they're, like, classic stories. They're not like continuity heavy. They're not really part of any particular time or a place in the main storyline. So,
what I thought was interesting is that even with the rotating artists, it really it was consistent in the feel for this is what this environment is like and this is what New York City is like in this world.
Right.
You know, even with the varying kind of degrees of you know, lightheartedness versus seriousness or versus you know whether it's violence or humor or whatever that's happening. My personal favorite, I mean, I love the story you did with Ryan Kelly, or there's this for people who are going to read this eventually, but there's a great story about what happened to the art in New York City and like little concepts like that, which I think are amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I have like a million questions like that, and I get asked a million questions like that. Well, like what's going on here, you know? And, I don't always like, God, I wish I could write something about that. You know, yeah. It's just like, there's only so much space. It's really, that's going to be like my regret with this book when all is said and done, because I felt like I wish every month I had like 70 pages, you know, to spend, you know.
Yeah.
And I really don't. So it's a real shame.
Yeah. but so now the book itself, so it reached 50 issues, and like you said, it's at a really grim point right now. Do you ever get to the point where you're worried that it's almost like the point of no return? I mean, you know, we talked before, and you said there is an end in mind and stuff like that. And I assume everything is moving towards that end, but is everything going to plan at least, or does it get kind of hard to keep control of the story?
No, I mean, it's very well planned out. I don't know how apparent or obvious that is, if at all. But I mean, everybody that reads it monthly and read issue 49 with that big event. Yeah. I mean, you can just like, you can, once you sort of saw that, you can just go all the way back to issue 29 when Maddie met Parco, you know, and that was like the beginning. It was sort of like, I mean, I felt like I was a little slightly obvious, you know, put a lot of writing on the wall all this time about how this is not going to end well, you know. You know, this Parco guy is not a good guy for Maddie to be so in love with, you know. You know, so I mean, I sort of like had that in mind all the way back at issue 29. So I mean, Maddie's story is like locked. Like I know exactly what's gonna happen between now and probably issue 70. So we got like just under a couple of years left. And you know, I'm still. I mean, the events around Maddie are always in the flux. Like I always sort of like, you know, adjust as I write, but I have like a general map of, you know, what's going to happen to the city and everything. So yeah, you know, let no one think this book is not going to a plan. DC kind of like want, like they really want it planned. Like they ask what's going to happen and like, I have to like plan everything out. So it's definitely locked.
I was just gonna say it just seems that with every arc that the temperature gets a little hotter and it just gets a little more intense and a little more, you know, and like you said, going back to when you introduced Parco, that's really been the big change in the story, because like I felt as if the early stories were getting a feel for the DMZ and a feel for the environment, but then like it wasn't until you introduced Parco that you really got to the story.
Yeah, at least in terms of like a main storyline. Sure. Yeah, and like when I created Parco, I was like, I mean, I didn't tell anybody this, but it's sort of like I'm gonna be like living with this guy for like the rest of the book. I mean, this is like I think if once the book's done and you step back, I mean, Parco's a huge part of it. He's like on par with like Maddie and Z, you know. And so I mean, we're gonna cool it down, like starting with issue 51, we're like cooling down. I mean, it's going to be a very solitary arc with like Maddie. He's sort of like, I mean, at the end of 49, without giving everything away, he sort of like self exiles himself, you know? So, I mean, it's going to be, it's not a slow arc, but it's like a separate arc. Like Maddie's kind of out of the Parco political world for like a bit. You know, he's sort of like doing a very important, very necessary bit of self-reflection, you know, after everything. And I always like say, you know, this recent arcs, it's like the rise of Maddie and then the fall of Maddie, you know, in 49. And so we're sort of like, I mean, he's going to have to sort himself out, you know, in the mess he's made now. I mean, that's what he has to do now, or give up, but I don't think he's going to give up.
So much of DMZ, at least when it started, you know, felt as if, you know, like, you know, it's this kind of like alternate present or ultimate, or, you know, alternate very short future. But, you know, like, it was kind of clear some of the political kind of influences, you know, from our world into the world of DMZ and stuff like that. As, you know, as the world has kind of changed since you started DMZ, has your approach to the story changed, or have you worked in kind of more recent developments? And just to preface, like, I'm not a politics arguer guy, so I'm not trying to make it into a politics discussion.
No, it's all right. No, it's a valid. It's totally valid. I think at the beginning it was very much a straightforward allegory, you know, of like, you know, the Iraq War. I did a lot of research beyond the Iraq War, but that was really, I mean, at the time that was like hot in the news, and that was what, you know, like, I feel like every interview I did was like about that. That was like, you know, it's major like draw, I guess. You know, it was quite a coincidence that the Parco story was happening at the same time as like Obama running for a president. Like I knew it was going to be like, I planned it that I was going to, excuse me, that I was going to write that story during the election year, during ours, you know? So that was in common, but then everybody saw Parco, and I think a lot of people just like made a assumption, that, oh, Parco's Obama, you know? And I'm like, well, first of all, he's really not Obama, you know? Like, he couldn't be further from him, you know, personality-wise. And also, it was kind of like a bit accidental. I mean, I had all the Parco stuff figured out, like, way, way before Obama became a candidate. So I've sort of, like, I've been aware that, you know, everybody was, like, looking to, like, connect those two. So I really I really tried hard not to make any obvious links. I wanted it to be separate. And now I feel like we're sort of getting into a zone where, I mean, with what happened in number 49, we're sort of out of current events now. We're sort of more into a more of like a futuristic, you know, what if scenario, whereas some of the earlier DMZs were very much, you know, about what was happening in the news. So it's like, it's shifting a bit, but I think it kind of has to. Like, everything has to like ramp up really, really high for like the end of the series, you know? So we're kind of getting more into like the science fiction-y realm, in terms of like the what if, like almost like an alternate history sort of thing.
And I think that it's interesting because, you know, as I've read it, I've tried to, you know, knowing that it was, you know, kind of based on that allegory, I've tried to say, okay, well, what, you know, what's going on here? How's that? What's going on in today's world? But it has deviated and it has become almost like this thing of its own self.
At some point it was, you know, it just had to be that way. I mean, you know, you can do an allegory up to a point, but I always figured like, where do I take this after that, you know?
If nobody's ever read DMZ, would you say that DMZ 50 is probably a good one to grab to get a feel for what the world is like, or?
Yeah. I mean, I consciously there's going to be stuff that isn't immediately clear. Like, I mean, you just kind of get introduced to, Wilson, you know, and, you know, I mean, obviously you don't know any of the Wilson backstory, so you might be like, oh, well, who's this guy? But I mean, the actual story in the book isn't going to, I mean, that's going to get to make sense. So, yeah, I would say I've been telling retailers this, too. I mean, this is like, I mean, use this to sort of like, you know, see if you can get anybody interested in the series. It's very broad. Like, it touches on a lot of different types of themes and stories and stuff. And we have all this great art. Riso's Wilson page it's really, really fantastic. Like, I saw that one thing and I was like, I wish I could just write like a Wilson spinoff book, like based on this one drawing. Like, there's so much in there. It was really, really cool. So yeah, definitely it's a, you know, a jumping on point, I guess. It's 32 pages of story in a 40 page book. There's a DVA preview in the back of it.
Oh, even better. So there you go.
yeah, I think it's $3.99 because it's a longer book. Yeah. My first, I shouldn't say that. I was going to say it's my first $3.99 book, but that's not true. That's what the market was, I guess. I forgot.
Yeah. But, you know, just the anthology aspect of it is great. I mean, just like the idea of this mini anthology in the DMZ world and even, you know, taking that same kind of nod from Transmet where like, you know, you could have easily had, you know, Jim Lee draw you a one-page pinup, but like to throw in the text to kind of to bolster.
Oh, yeah. I really did not want any, like, you know, pinup pages. You know, I didn't want a gallery. Like, I wanted it to be you know, I wanted there to be writing on every page, you know, story on every page.
Yeah, no, it's great. And so that makes the Jim Lee page and the Dave Givens page and the Philip Bond page just so much better. And I want to talk to you about the Fabio Moon story. It's a silent story. No, there's no dialogue, right?
Yeah.
The copy I got. I'm hoping I got the right copy.
No, that's absolutely right. And that was a case of, I think he was the first artist I asked way back when. So it was definitely a case of like knowing who the artist was before I wrote it. You know, and with him, like I just like if there was anybody I was ever gonna write a silent story for, it'd be him because he'd really really, you know, do well with that. So yeah, I mean sure, it's like I think that's one of the four pagers. But it's great. I mean, he did it perfectly. I always like feel slightly bad bringing a new artist into like the DMZ world because they have to draw so much crap. It's like anytime I draw like, you know, any city you shot, it's like a lot of work, you know? So, but he handled it well.
Yeah. You know, all that rubble.
Without anger or anything.
Yeah. And the story really works. I mean, from a storytelling standpoint, it you don't need any words to see what's going on. And so, you know, in terms of
And we did that thing with the color. I guess you don't have a color version.
No, I don't, unfortunately. Yeah.
But that object that kid has is it's almost a black and white story. Like it's like toned, but it's like with a slight color thing. But it's an unexploded cluster bomb. It's like bright orange. So it really pops, and that also helps the story too.
Cool, yeah. Well, it's great. I mean, I've been reading DMZ since issue one, and this has just been a great little, you know, like it's almost like a moment to exhale in between what just happened and what's coming. You know, like it's a nice,
yeah. I think everybody needed it. Yeah. I mean, I needed it.
Yeah.
So I'm sure and Ricardo got to do a cover, which is I know so something he's wanted to do. You know. So it was a nice sort of breather for everybody, really. Except the editors that had to organize all that.
I'm sure that was a ton of work.
Yeah.
So now issue 51 picks up, you know, the next storyline, and who's Ricardo going to be the artist on that? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
We're back to that. It's a short arc. I think it's four issues long, and so issue 50 is going to be part of that trade. So that's the other thing. This issue 50 isn't going to be put into a trade for a year.
Oh wow!
So if that's a factor, and anybody that normally reads via trades, you know, if they didn't want to wait, because I think we have volume 8 coming out. I think they're actually changing it. I think it's going to come out in the spring now, possibly May. And so it's going to be like 6 months or so after that the volume 9 is out and that has this issue in it.
All right. Well, good to know. So if you want your DMZ kind of anthology fix, get it next week. So,
right.
Cool. So, all right. So your other Vertigo book, Northlanders, which we talked about when we last talked about at the beginning of this arc, this Plague Widow arc, And so the issue that's coming out this month in February is coming out at the end of the month, like February 24th, issue number 25. So it's like a milestone month for you. Seriously, 50, 25, 1.
I know. It all kind of happened all by accident. I really lobbied to get a Deviate to start this month, but I think it was deemed to be too much. You know? didn't want to spread it out too much, you know, spread out the orders. You know?
Yeah, sure.
So that's why I think there's also going to be a Deviate preview in the Northlanders as well.
Cool. So now while Northlanders might be issue number 25, it is the middle of an arc of an eight issue arc, so it might not be the best jumping on.
So there's no anniversary there.
but it was funny because we just talked about issue 24 on the last episode of our Pick of the Week podcast.
And, oh really?
Yeah,
oh,
yeah. It just yeah. So and we were talking about it, and both Josh and I. Josh from My Fanboy and I were talking about how fantastic this arc has been, this Plague Widow arc. It's you know, I don't know if it's the 8-issue length or the art of Leandro Fernandez or the story itself. It's probably a combination of everything, but we've just been ridiculously impressed at how good this one is. Not saying that the other ones weren't as good, but this one just seems that something special to this story arc.
Yeah, well, I think. And I was talking about this in an interview I did. I've been doing a lot of these things in the last week. But I really feel like Northland is, because of the way it's built, because of the structure of the book, like I should be getting better exponentially with each arc. You know, because I'm given this chance to like start the book over again, really, with each arc. So I should be applying everything I learn in one arc into the next, you know, in theory, I say. But that, I mean, that's how it should work. I mean, I'm given the chance to basically, you know, start over again each time. So, I mean, I really, I've learned that 8-issue length is great, for this book, because, these aren't arcs, you know, really in a larger story. They're not arcs in the traditional comic book sense. They are like from beginning to end a complete isolated story. So I felt like maybe 6 issues wasn't enough to give sort of like the epic feel, you know, and feel like a very satisfying chunk. So I think any larger arc from now on is going to be 8. Actually, I'm a liar. I'm totally a liar because the one after this is only 5.
Well, yeah. Well.
So I totally just lied. Yeah, sorry. So I guess I'm not doing it in 8-issue arc.
Well,
but
the future
ones might
be 8 issues.
I try, yes. The reason why the one after this is short because of the artists we're getting. That's all the time they had in their schedule. So I mean, obviously, I'm writing it, you know, to be a lot denser, to try to like pack as much into the 5 issues as I can. But Deviate is 8 issues long, if that helps.
Well, it makes sense because of the title, right? Deviate and 8 issues.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so I feel like that's a great length for this book. I really felt like that first trade was epic in that sense. That it was long.
Yeah, and part of the 8-issue length on the story is that you just feel. I feel really like, especially in this story, where you know it's a Russian town in like what, like 900 something. You know, and they're 1020. That's what it is, and they're living in fear of a plague or in fear of disease being spread. And you just feel so like reading it. I just feel so entrenched and cold and alone and scared. And it's just like it's amazing to see how you and Leandro have been able to keep that tone from issue to issue to issue. And I keep saying entrenched, like I just don't feel like I don't see where the end is, you know, like it's just like this is your like in the reality with the characters.
It's the whole cold thing is I've been a bit obsessed with that in this arc. I read this book, I don't have it here, I can't tell you what it's called, but it's sort of like this book that was about like extremes, like extreme heat and cold, like extreme things like the ocean floor and outer space. And I remember I read the section about cold, and it explains like you know what happens to the human body when it freezes, basically, or when you get hypothermia or a frostbite, and why you're colder when it's windy. It's like a very technical book, and I think it gave me nightmares when I read it, because it was like horrible, like a horrible, horrible book, you know. And it's like I never wanted to leave the house after that. And so it's sort of like I read it years ago, and it's sort of like it's been like this like obsession in the back of my head, like I got to write a story that's like this, you know. It's like Whiteout in a way. So this was like a great chance, and I really hammered it home in the script. I tried to like make this look as cold as possible, as cold as possible. In a way, not to take anything away from the colorist, who's awesome. I love Dave, but like when Leo's pages come back, like it's cold. Like he really pulled it off, and I think it helps because his art is the way it is. You know, it's very stark, but yeah, it's coming along great. I think that I'm the most happy with this story out of all of them.
This is gonna be a great trade when it comes out. This is gonna be a great one.
And because of its length, it allows you to do like several twists. Like it's not like this, like, you know, there's one peak event. You know, there's like several as we go. What just happened in number four, when like Gunborg goes out, you know, and what does whatever he does. I mean, this is kind of the beginning of like the build up to like this big conflict, but there's going to be this whole other thing with Hilda and that guy that keeps coming around, the guy that killed her friend. There's that too. So I can sort of have like, you know, several things happening at once in that length, which is nice. And it's gonna, like, everybody's like, man, I don't know what's gonna happen, you know. Like, how's he gonna make this, like, how's he gonna draw this out for like another four issues? But I mean, there's a lot of stuff that I'm setting up. The whole Gunborg Boris conflict is obviously gonna play out too.
And that's fascinating, because you've got the plague widow, you got Hilda, the main character, and it's a story of, you know, survival for her. But then you've got this great kind of, you know, religion versus kind of reality, you know, kind of argument that's going on with the monk-like character with Boris, and then with everybody else. And in a time period where, you know, they know nothing about science or disease, you know, how to cure disease or anything like that. So it's...
That's actually been a little hard to write, actually, because I take it for granted, like, stuff about, like, you know, how, like even what being sick is, you know, like you sort of like you rationally know that, you know, you have, you know, a virus in your body that has to like work its way out or whatever. But then they didn't know a clue. For all they know, it came from God. You know, God is making them sick. I mean, so that's a constant thing I have to keep reminding myself of. You know. It's really with Boris and Gunborg, it's really almost like an intellectualism versus like the opposite of that, I don't know, populism or something. I mean, Boris is like the smart one. He's the only one that like knows all these facts, and he's like laughed at for like using big words, you know. You know, we don't want any of that, you know. So
right. and then you throw in the level of, you know, like I said, you know, I say like realism, like you got these, you know, these warriors who just know what's in front of them, you know, like, you know, there's a danger, right. Kill it, you know, like that sort of thing. So it's this barbarianism almost, you know.
This is really my first attempt at writing anything like a horror book, and that was kind of what I wanted to do at the beginning, like a survival horror. And not to use a cliche, but it really does get a lot worse.
So issue 25 comes out later this month, and you know, if you haven't picked it up, if you can go find the back issues, I would say do it. But and it's gonna be a great trade when it comes out. That's the one thing. Leandro Fernandez's art is just fantastic. So good.
I know. I'm dying to. I'm actually like been racking my brain trying to figure out what he and I can do next. Because we really work together well. Like we both agree. I'm just trying to find like space in my schedule.
Yeah, well, that's the challenge. Well, with this packed month, I can't imagine you have any space.
Well, I'm writing five books now, which is kind of nuts. I mean, that was kind of a mistake. Like, I really can handle four comfortably, but there's a bit of overlap because I just started the New York 4.
Right.
And I'm not done with demo yet, so that's overlap, blocking a bit.
So is New York 4 going to come out under Vertigo or?
Yeah,
oh, awesome.
It's actually going to be It's going to be just like Leg Demo in terms of a six issue monthly black and white book. And obviously, it's structured differently, but you know, physically, it's like Demo.
I love that book. I was glad to hear that it was going to live on beyond Minx, because that book, just, you know, being from New York and everything, it was a blast to read. So
yeah, it's coming along good. I've written two scripts, and Ryan's drawing the second one now.
Oh, that's great, awesome.
So I'm not sure when that appears though.
Yeah, somewhere down the line, some to look forward to. Yep. But so speaking of things to look forward to, so in April, and as you mentioned earlier, you got Deviate. Now, this is, you know, we had talked about Deviate for a while now, and you're saying this is like kind of your pet, you know, kind of dream project, right?
yeah, it really is.
So I think when people hear that, and then knowing that it was a, you know, late 90s Wildstorm title, that kind of gets some people to kind of, you know, kind of be curious. So why are you so attracted to the title Deviate?
It was, I always preface this by saying that, like, I'm not like a lot of my peers, and I didn't grow up reading comics. Like, they didn't, like, imprint on me at, like, a young age, which is kind of, like, explains why I don't really work on the company books all that much. But Deviate was a book that I read, I think it was actually more like the mid-90s. I think 96 is when those Warren Ellis books came out. And that was right around the time when I, you know, was kind of like, you know, really, really immersing myself in comics and thinking maybe this is what I wanted to do with my life. And so this book came out, and I knew Warren's name, which is why I read it. And, I remember just being appalled. Like, I could not believe someone printed this book. I mean, you look back, I mean, it's still like quite, I mean, it ages really well in terms of, like, you know, it's like shock factor. And it's like, there's stuff in there that I don't think Wildstorm would actually print now. There's like straight up incest.
Right. Well, it was pre-DC Wildstorm too, right?
I guess that explains it. I mean, people are like doing coke off of the street, like physically bending down and doing coke off the street. And there's a girl with a vagina, like a giant vagina mouth in her stomach, you know? And I'm just like, I remember looking at that and I'm like, oh my God, I cannot believe this. This is awesome. You know, I didn't think you could actually do this stuff, you know, in these like sort of like mainstream books. So, and the arc, like Warren's arc is just like, it's just great. I mean, it's super smart, and it's like the best of Warren I've felt. You know, I still feel, even though he might laugh at me for saying that. And it's sort of like, you know, always like stayed with me. I feel like it like helped inform a lot of the stuff I've done. So certainly like this, you know, writing teens, you know, in a specific way. I felt like I always like refer back to that book a lot. And so it was the first thing I wanted to write at Wildstorm, whenever it was Wildstorm, you know, approached me. Well, you know, they're like, is there anything you want to pitch? I'm like, this. And they're like, no, that's done. You know, I think at the time, whoever it was had decided they were like, you know, that book and like run its course, you know? And I would try off and on over the years. I think I pitched it four times separately. And this most recent time, Ben, the editor there, you know, asked me if I wanted to write this one of their other books. And I said, I don't really know that book all that well, but I do know this. And he's like, we're not doing that book. And it's like the same thing. And I was like, man, come on. It's turning into like my white whale, you know? And so, so I just went ahead and pitched it as if he said yes. I figured, well, I just got to like, at the very least I can like pitch it. So they know what I'm talking about, you know? And I pitched it, and they were like, And then they approved it in like a week. I hope it's because it's like really, really great. But I hope they're not just humoring me. I'm sure they're not. But it's a great. I mean, I really hope that. I really tried hard to like reintroduce this book, and I hope it like has a life beyond just these eight issues I'm writing. Like I hope it becomes like a constant presence, you know, in the imprint, because I really do like it, and I really love all those characters. And, you know, hats off to everybody, you know, Jim Lee and Warren and everybody that kind of built them up. They're really, I don't really think a lot of people get how interesting and unique they are. It's a great raw material as a writer, those guys.
Well, considering how dating back to the '90s, I don't even know if that old stuff is still in print or not. I don't think it is, but,
no, only Warren's trade is, which is, I mean, that was a big part of how I wrote this new book. So I think there was in the total 32 issues of that book. I went on eBay and bought them, and only the first six are actually in print. So and like all kinds of shit happens, you know, between issue 7 and 32. And I remember at the beginning, I'm like, well, that stuff isn't in print. Like I almost feel like I have to ignore all that just for the sake of like accessibility. I mean, if I picked up on those abandoned storylines from like a decade plus ago, that means anybody that wanted to read mine would either be like completely ignorant or would have to like do what I did and scour eBay, you know, and like assemble a run, which wasn't practical at all. So it's a pretty, you know, so I just kind of looked at like Warren's take on them and used that as a basis, and I relaunched it. I felt like that was the only sane thing to do. Because I want it to, you know, to be something everybody can kind of pick up and read, even if they haven't read it, everything, you know. So
now does Deviate exist within the Wildstorm universe proper? Like, is it, you know?
Yes, although not in my story, if that makes sense. Like, in my story, they're actually not on Earth. And they return to Earth at the end. So, in theory, they're, you know, they're like, it's at the same time as the current like World's End stuff, but they're physically not there.
Yeah,
all right. If that makes sense. Yeah, if I'm being clear.
Sure. Yeah.
It's not like an alternate history, or it's not like a classic story or something. It is happening right now in terms of the Wildstorm books, but and then they rejoin Earth at the end. So. If there's ever any deviate after it, it is part of the World's End stuff.
Cool. And so now, for, you know, considering the age of the material and the lack of the reprint, so somebody who's never read Warren stuff or is never heard of Deviate, like what's the small pitch for it, or what, you know, aside from, you know, doing coke off the street, you know, like, who are these characters, you know, like, yeah.
I mean, I think it's going to be helpful if someone has even like a very rudimentary knowledge of Wildstorm. I mean, the carriers in it, right? And I just assume people know what that is, or at the very least, they'd be like, okay, it's a spaceship, you know? I mean, yeah, but it's there, and then I don't explain what the carrier is. It's just there. So there's, I mean, I think it helps if you kind of get a few things like that, but, and you sort of get that these characters were like in like a lab. They're like lab rat type guys. That's not super, super important though. And what it is they're actually very, very much like DMZ. And that is just occurring to me now, is these characters kind of get dropped into like this foreign world, with zero explanation or prep. And, this world happens to be like a stone age, very Earth-like planet, but set back when everybody was carrying spears around. And the thing with these kids is that all their powers, I've realized early on, were very like, you know, sort of elemental primal powers, like heat and cold, super size, things like that. So it really felt like old gods. I mean, I kind of pulled on some of my Norse god knowledge for this. And if they literally drop from the sky, which is what they do in the first page of the book, they are gods to someone 5,000 years ago. You know, they're like, they're the exact definition of a god. You know, and they act like gods. They're like temperamental and angry because they're like pissed off kids. irrational, and they one of them can grow as big as a giant. So I mean, that's a god, you know. So I just sort of like played off of that, and they sort of drop down, and they don't really like each other all that much, and they kind of never have. So they quickly kind of find homes in various friendly tribes, and sort of like use them and as like proxy armies in a war against each other. Like some of them come down and they're like, awesome, we're gods. All these people worship me. I'm gonna max this out. You know, I'm gonna make them do what I want because I'm a god. They're on power trips. And other ones are like, I don't really know if we should be playing gods, you know, with all these people's lives. So there's a lot of conflict there, which then plays out in various ways throughout the eight issues. I mean, that's not very brief, I'm sorry.
No, but that's the kind of thing. It's a play on the powers and like you said, godhood. And the title, Gods and Monsters, it kind of sums it up as well.
Right, it's a very literal title.
Yeah. And you're working with Rebecca Isaacs, who has a story in DMZ, I say, as well, right?
Yeah. She actually did that quite recently. We've been working on DVA for like a long time. We're actually almost done. DMZ came after we had been working together for months and months. And she's great. She's like, pretty new. She did a bunch of Devil's Due stuff, I believe. And she did one Marvel fill-in on Miss Marvel before DVA, but she's very new, very young, very talented.
Yeah, and she's been executed because the look of the DVA characters is fairly unique in terms of, you know, if I remember correctly.
I know, and I'm like a big dick because I've been wanting to write this book for like a decade. So I'm like been a little picky about it. Like in my mind, I know exactly what I want it to look like, you know, especially with the covers, like Fiona Staples. I apologize to her every time I see it. Because I feel like I'm like bossing her around too much, and she's like, "No, it's cool. Just tell me what to do." You know,
it's artistic vision.
Yeah, I'm like very careful. Like that image, like that cover of number two, with that big black and white face that's like half painted. You know, like I've had that in my head forever. You know, like for at least a couple of years. Like that's the cover. You know, so they've all been very, very kind because I think I've been very, very specific about what I want.
So has it been a trip to see that 10-year-old vision of yours come to reality? I mean, has it made it harder to work with them because if it's not going the direction you want it to, or have you been lucky in that it has?
No, it has. I mean, I'm not like a tyrant about it. And I also just had to recognize that, like, I'm not going to get what's in my head. It's just not physically possible at this point. You know, I've sort of, like, built it up too much. I've been flexible, obviously, a lot, especially, you know, with, like, you know, talking with the editor, you know, them reining in a lot of the crazy stuff I wanted to do. But I did write this entire document, which I want to put online at some point, about their costumes because I changed some of them around, and it's like this like 8-page document.
Wow.
About the philosophy of like, you know, why I want to change their costumes and everything like that. So it's a little crazy. I like to think I got all that craziness out of the way in the first couple months, so now it's normal.
Cool. So, all right, so that comes out in April. So the first issue comes out, and you know, if you read Wildstorm and stuff, you definitely want to, you know, kind of check that out. And geez, wow, it sounds super interesting. But you mentioned one thing earlier when we talked about Deviate, about how you went out and bought off of eBay the complete run.
Yep.
And I've heard other creators say that. So when you buy something on eBay and then you have to give the person your address, does the person ever go like, oh my God, you're Brian Wood?
Once in a while, because I actually do buy a lot of, I mean, this is going to sound lame, but I buy a lot of my own books off of eBay. like it sounds funny, but I realized like, man, I don't actually have a complete run of the original demo. Like I'm like a missing a couple, you know, just for very, like I move and it gets lost or I give them away and I don't really realize I'm giving away my last copy. So there are times I go on there and I'm like, I need a copy of something that's like unavailable otherwise. And like every so often somebody will put two and two together and see like, oh, somebody named Brian Wood is buying my eBay item demo by Brian Wood, you know? And sometimes they'll ask, you know, and they're like, what are you doing? And then I say, well, you know, I'm buying this for, like, my archives. I actually don't have a set, and I feel like a loser, you know, that I can't, like, you know, that the writer of the book can't, like, summon up copies on command, but I really can't. So in this case, no, but off for other things, yes. You don't always get them. I mean, or if you get, or you don't get enough.
Yeah. If I were selling demo issues on eBay and you contacted me to buy them, I couldn't charge you for it. I would just say, like, I just like, it's got to be weird.
Well, I don't know. I'm sure. I mean, I guess once you win an auction,
yeah, you have to, right?
Yeah. Choice, but I mean, I wouldn't take it for free anyway.
Yeah. But I like the idea of buying all the old Deviate issues from the 90s. Going, hey, wait a minute, this is the guy writing it.
Yeah. I mean, the Wildstorm didn't have them, you know. I mean, they're old. I mean, they're quite old. So, and I think by the time that book ended, it was kind of obscure too. Like, I think it had fallen off a lot. I can't believe that first Deviate number one was like sold 200,000 copies.
Oh my God! Pretty did funny. It really?
Well, it had a lot of variant covers. It had 8 variant covers.
Wow.
But it was before Warren was known. I mean, I think Transmet might have been around, like, in the early days, but that was when it was like some very random Helix book, you know. And it just had like had a ton of variant covers by like everybody who was hot at the time. So.
Yeah, and that was riding the whole Wildcats into Gen 13 into Deviate kind of wave. Sorry if I remember that correctly. So
yeah.
Yeah, it's cool. Well, it's good that you're resuscitating it, you know, especially considering you put so much thought into it over the years. I mean, it's not like it's a random, hey, I'm just going to play with these characters. Like, this is like, you know, something you've been working towards. So it's cool to see it happen.
Right.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
Awesome. All right. Well, I've taken up more than enough of your time, I think. So
yeah, fine. I always like doing podcasts. It's really easy.
Yeah, no, it's great. Yeah.
I could just like pick up the phone and talk.
Yeah. So just to recap for everybody, so Demo is in stores this week, so pick that up.
Yeah.
DMZ comes out next week on February 10th, and Northlanders on the end of the month, February 24th, and then in April comes Deviate. So
And also I'll say really quick, the volume 3 of Northlanders is out the week after, so that's like the first week of March. Which that is the one that collects all the short stories, all those like one shots and two parters. And I think it's the best one. I think I'm gonna do one of those. If someone hates it, they can mail it back to me and I'll pay them back.
Wow, that's bold. Okay.
so I mean, I mean you're welcome to put that online, obviously, but I'm going to do a more formal announcement soon.
Some money back guarantee on Northlanders Volume 3, huh? Wow.
Yeah.
That's when a couple other creators have done that, and I think that's just so, like, it's just, you know, I would, you know, and it, what's what I find amazing is that, you know, you've done it, and some other folks have done it on books that I would never even consider sending back. You know what I mean? Like, I can't, you know, like, they're good, they're quality books, so. So hopefully,
like, I remember when Jason Aaron did it on Scout.
Yeah.
You
know,
so.
Funny. Yeah. So hopefully nobody takes you up on that offer. <'Cause> the,
yeah. So. But I'm ready for it. Yeah. I mean, I really am. So right. I don't mind making out of the offer on this book, because I really think it's. I mean, I think Northlanders has currently my strongest writing, and especially these stories, I feel like are very, very strong.
Yeah. Excellent. So then we look forward to New York 4 down the road as well.
I mean, I couldn't even begin to tell you when.
No, but some of them.
They always wait until we have 4 done before they put it on the schedule.
Yeah.
And, you know, their schedule is always very busy, so it could be the end of the year for all I know.
Yeah,
so.
Well, that's fine. Yeah, we'd rather have them be done and in the can than late and delayed and things like that, so... Yep. Not that they would be, but still, the chance that it happens.
Possible. I've been late on DMZ a couple of months.
Yeah, so. Well, that happens.
A couple of times.
Well, hopefully you'll find a moment to take a break in the upcoming months after a busy month like this.
Now it's like I'm getting into the point where I have to start pitching what I want to replace DMZ with, believe it or not. I mean, that far in advance. Like, I want it all set up so there's no downtime, you know. So I'm already in that mode. It's crazy.
So awesome. All right, well, we'll let you get back to work. So thank you very much, Brian. We appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you.
I want to thank Brian for giving us some of his time and his very busy schedule with a full plate of books coming up, including a New York 4, which we heard a little more about, which I can't wait to see come out. So check out Brian Wood's work. If you go to ifanboy.com/comics, you can pull Demo, Northlanders, DMZ, Deviate, put all that stuff on your pull list, go to the store, pick it up, check it out. Demo was particularly good. So if you haven't checked it out in the stores yet, go pick it up. In the meantime, go to ifanboy.com, check out all the great writing and podcasts and everything we got there. And if you have any questions or want to suggest a creator we talk to, shoot us an email, contact@ifanboy.com. I'll see you next time.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means. And I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert extrovert thing. And some people, you know, like they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away. And, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened, but it can be tough to deal with. And also one of the things is like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.